This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up this weekend in Gary, in fact, at the Glen Theater on Ridge Road in Gary, will be the 9th Annual Film Festival, which is going to be hosted by Gary native and a Hollywood actor. Our next guest here on the program, William L. Johnson. It's a very interesting series of films coming up this year, and we'll find out all about them. Mr. Johnson, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Well, for people, we've been doing this for 9 years, but I'm sure there's probably somebody listening that probably doesn't know very much about William L. Johnson. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and since you're a native of Gary, what got you that move from Gary all the way to Hollywood?
You know, I moved out here some 15 years ago, you know, to pursue music, and but theater was always in my blood, so, you know, I ended up taking a couple of took a couple of acting classes, and that led me to get an agent, and I kind of started booking work kind of fast. So I've been pretty successful since I've been here. I've worked on a film project, you know, every year since I've been here, if not three or four, and I have four projects I'm working on right now. I'm studying for.
Wow. Wow, what kind of roles do you tend to get? You're not. I take it you're not necessarily locked into a character of acting of any kind, but you apparently do a number of things. What are some of the roles that you have done and you're most interested in?
Well, I like to play different characters. You know, like with this new character I'm studying right now is he's a drug addict and he's going to end up becoming a motivational speaker. You know what I mean? So I like characters to have some contrast and grow. And I'm working on another piece with a director writer in Chicago, Ken Lewis. It's a television series called Vice Grip, and I'm playing like a character like one of my uncles from back in the 70s. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I play a wide range of characters. If you ever seen any of my work, you can see the difference. You know, I like to pride myself and separate each character that I play, you know?
We know you're a native of Gary, and we also know, too, that you're a graduate of Emerson High School back in 1988. Did any of your classmates in high school even think that you were going to be able to fit into this type of career? Did you do acting for some of the school facilities, school plays, and things like that?
Oh, yeah, man. I did a gang of musicals coming up in Emerson Visual and Performing Arts, man. That's where the bug bit me.
Mm-hmm.
When you
got involved in all the high school acting and got, of course, that finally led eventually to what you're doing in Hollywood with the roles that you're doing there, what got you interested in setting up the film festival?
You know what? Vernon talked to me, called me up and was interested in doing something at the Glen Theater because, you know, he has access to it. Mm-hmm. And he was wanting to do something for Black History Month. He, you know, presented the film festival, and I just jumped right on.
We should mention Vernon, you're referring to, is State Representative Vernon Smith of Gary.
Yeah.
Of course, and he's also the festival's director, and he's also the board chairman as well, I understand, of African American Achievers, a number of groups all together. And in fact, the theater actually owns and operates the theater there on Ridge Road. And they, are, of course, give you a perfect venue to have a film festival like this. And in the past, what types of films have been shown? Since this is the 9th annual, we'll get into the program for this coming weekend, but what kinds of films in the past have you been able to showcase to folks here in Gary and Northwest Indiana?
Well, we've been able to showcase feature films that, you know, come out eventually. Sometimes we've had films that they've been the first to see them. We've had films where they probably were just learning, people just getting it going with our short films. We have a wide range of people from all over who submit films, but we stay consistent now with films that make you laugh and make you feel good, you know, very interesting concepts and topics. Because now we kind of know what our audience likes, you know what I mean? So we try to really cater toward, you know, what the people say that they like.
Well, you've had 8 years to be able to find out exactly what folks in Northwest Indiana, and particularly in Gary and surrounding area, would like to see. Let's go through the list of films that are on this 9th Annual Film Festival program for this year. We should mention, by the way, that the films are going to be shown on Friday the 21st, beginning at 6:30 in the evening, and again Saturday on the 22nd, beginning at 7 in the evening. And as we mentioned, they're all going to be shown at the Glenn Theater, which is, by the way, at 20 West Ridge Road, which means it is just right literally around the corner from Broadway on Ridge Road there in Gary. Let's go through the list of films here. And first we'll start out, I guess, with the programs that are going to come up here on the Friday evening program. I guess one in particular, is going to start with is a feature film called Chasing After You. Tell us about that.
You know what? Chasing After You, you know, it's one of those things that I don't really want to give it away.
Okay.
But it is a really, all of the films, what I can say is the technology and the more outlets that people are now having to showcase and get their products out, people are really stepping up to the plate with really good storylines, great acting, great cinematography. So you're really getting a chance to see some films, you know, that you probably never would have seen before. You know, I want to give that one away.
Okay.
But what I want to do is just have people to come out and be surprised, yeah. You know, because, you know, sometimes I am, you know, because sometimes we throw a short film in there that I haven't seen. But I can say these films here, they're all good. They're going to love them.
That's
they're going to like The Final Exam, and you're really going to love Child Support. My boy Reggie Gastons, that's a film that he wrote and directed.
Yeah, this is a very interesting list of titles to take a look at this weekend, to be sure.
We got Grandma's House.
Yeah.
One Last Bye. You know what I mean? The Truth Shall Make You Free. The Final Exam. You know, we got some really cool titles, you know. Part of Me. The Unwilling. You know? So I would suggest people come on out and get this famous popcorn. And sit down and have a great time watching some very great films.
I know the goal and the objective of the festival is to be able to showcase a wide variety of independent African-American films for the audience here in Northwest Indiana. What have you noticed in the films over the now will be 9 years, including the ones that are going to be on showing this weekend, of how black artists, and we're talking about all artists, not only actors, but you say filmmakers and editors and the like, what do they seem to be able to take from the new technology and the changes that they have been able to put into these films, almost every year, it seems like?
Yeah. You know, with these people now, you have special effects. You know, you can blow something up now without blowing something up. We had a film 2 years ago, and this guy, he made a superhero movie, and it was very good. And these superheroes had powers and everything. You know, it's a lot that they're doing. And now I just shot something yesterday with a new cinematographer, and he had the new Black Magic camera.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks amazing. So these cameras now with this thing, and it's just bananas, the stuff that they're doing. And with the gimbals, you know, the stuff that make the cameras move from side to side, I've been really seeing some really good art, really good shots. Even with the I have a friend of mine, he's really, really good with the drone, man. I mean, wow. You know, even you're seeing stuff you never would have seen before if you hadn't had these drones. You know what I mean?
That's
you're
great.
Getting angles, you're getting all kind of stuff, man. So it's very interesting to see what people do with it.
And we should mention the tickets for the showings for both Friday night, the 21st, and Saturday evening, the 22nd. Our tickets for both nights are $30. And advanced tickets, I guess, are still on sale, even though I know you're probably coming up to the deadline. But you can you can get tickets at the door there at the Glenn Theater if you can't get them in advance here. But you want to do your best to be able to do so.
It's advanced 20, and then it's 25 at the door.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Friday. And then it's 15 in advance for Saturday and 20 at the door.
Well, it sounds like that this is going to be a great opportunity for folks in Northwest Indiana, if they have not checked it out in the past, to head over to the Glenn Theater on Ridge Road in Gary.
Oh, yeah. You're going to enjoy it. You're going to have a great time.
That's great. Great to hear. Well, Mr. Johnson, thank you for spending time with us to talk about some of the an idea of some of the films that are going to come up here. They'll be on the schedule for this weekend's 9th Annual Film Festival. It's going to happen again at the Glenn Theater, which is at 20 West Ridge Road, which is just, as we said, around the corner from Broadway and Ridge Road in the Gary. And we certainly hope that you have a great crowd and people showing up. You know that people are going to certainly you'll do your best to make sure that they have a very entertaining weekend.
Right on. And thank you, Chris. I appreciate you, man, for having me on. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. William L. Johnson is a native of Gary. He's a graduate of Emerson High School in theatrics and all. And he is an actor in Hollywood, a very busy guy, it seems like. And he is also the host for the now 9th Annual Film Festival coming up this weekend in Gary. Americans are divided on lots of issues, it seems. A new national survey shows that people across the political spectrum do agree, though, on at least one thing. Our healthcare system needs to be fixed. The survey from Public Agenda and USA Today found 92% of Americans say changes are needed, and there's a widespread concern there about making healthcare more affordable. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman had a chance to talk with some of the participants in the survey, and she brings us this report.
I connected with people all across the political spectrum who were eager to share their stories. People like 51-year-old Celeste Smith, a Republican in Bella Vista, Arkansas. She was diagnosed with thyroid cancer in 2014. Even with insurance and paying some costs up front, the surgery she needed left her on the hook for $6,000.
Which I didn't have. And it was very, very difficult for us to try and negotiate making payments to the hospital.
Smith ended up getting sued by a collection agency.
I'm trying to recover from, you know, having this cancer surgery and getting it removed and the subsequent meds and tests that I have to get done. We did wind up, you know, making a deal with them to pay a smaller amount, which they agreed to. But it took having my credit essentially ruined for a couple of years. They got their money ultimately, but it really hurt us.
Kelly Schmid in Faribault, Minnesota, can relate. She's 48 and politically independent. She has a health condition that has required numerous surgeries to remove cysts and bone spurs. And when she was in her 30s, her health got worse.
I got really sick and we couldn't figure out why. My deductible at that time in 2004 was $1,150. And so we maxed that out probably, I think, at the end of January, beginning of February. I mean, that's 1 month into the year. And this year in 2020, my deductible is $11,500. And we are going to hit that max by the end of next month. The deductibles go up every year. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. They just go up.
Schmidt is frustrated with the rising rates and the fact that it's often impossible to know what a procedure is going to cost up front. In Boston, 35-year-old Michael Weidman, a left-leaning independent, shares that sentiment.
You know, just this month I went to the dentist and it cost me something like $400. And that's a lot of money. And that's with insurance. I know for a lot of people that would be severely difficult to cover. I can afford to pay some of these costs, but I'm also avoiding healthcare at the same time. For instance, I would greatly benefit from going to see a counselor, as would a lot of people, but most insurance doesn't cover counseling, mine including.
The people I spoke with place blame in different places: doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, even politicians. But the survey shows Republicans and Democrats actually have very similar goals for the healthcare system, like making it more affordable. They also largely agree that people with pre-existing conditions should be able to get coverage, that the elderly and disabled should have long-term care, and that hospitals should be more transparent about prices.
And they also have very relatively similar ideas on how it should go about doing that.
Chris Jackson is with the research firm Ipsos, which conducted the survey with Public Agenda and USA Today.
The commonality only really starts to break down when you talk about who's going to pay for things. And that's still sort of the point of division.
But Jackson sees hope. He says the findings suggest that if we can focus on common ground, it could be the beginning of a less vitriolic, more productive dialogue about how to create a healthcare system that works for all Americans. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Christine Herman, America Amplified.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford, and today we're going to do something a little bit different. I'm just going to go ahead and freestyle a little bit about careers in the construction industry. I talk to a lot of people, especially students that are in high school, about careers, but there's a lot of people who are out of high school and kind of trying to find what they want to do for a living. So I kind of want to put out some information out there and, you know, maybe dispel some of the myths and talk about what goes on in our industry. So another thing that we like to hang our hat on is our training. I mean, our training is second to none. The trade jobs that exist, the skill trades where most of the jobs exist, like your iron workers and your carpenters, all the individuals that get into those trades, they have to go through an apprenticeship program. And if you're not familiar with an apprenticeship program, it's kind of a job, but at the same time, you're also going to school. So it's kind of like college, but you're getting paid as you're working. So a typical apprenticeship program, and I should preface this by saying that all apprenticeship programs operate independently, so they all have different ways of structuring their program. But typically, about 80% of the time, you're out on the job, you're learning from people who have already been through the apprenticeship program, they're teaching you out in the field how to do things for your particular trade. And then about 20% of the time, you're in school. So basically 4 days a week, you're going to be working on the job, earning a paycheck, and then one day a week, you're in school and you're learning about what that particular trade does. So just to give you an example, if you're an electrician, you're schooling, you're going to learn about AC theory, DC theory, transformer theory. And then when you're out in the field, you're actually working on the transformers or you're wiring a facility. So that's typically how it works. And then as you go through the program, you start off at a somewhat lower wage. You know, the average wage, I would say, and I don't have the data on this, but I would say it's between like $13 and $18 an hour starting off. And then as you go through the program and you complete your schooling and you can complete your on-the-job requirements, on-the-job training requirements, your pay increases incrementally. The typical apprenticeship program term is about 4 years. Some trades have 5-year programs. Others have 3. But I would say on average it's about 4 years before you can complete the entire apprenticeship program. If you want to know more information, you know, that website that I mentioned earlier, We Build Northwest Indiana, has all that information. And one thing that a lot of people don't know is that 12 of the 20 trades offer a degree from Ivy Tech Community College once you complete the apprenticeship program. So not only are you earning a trade and skills that are transferable to anywhere in the country, but you're also getting a 2-year degree in many of these trades. Another thing is the program's completely debt-free. Doesn't cost you anything to go into the program. One thing is the learning doesn't end once you complete your apprenticeship program. A lot of the trades offer what they call as journeyman upgrade. So once you complete the trade, you're considered a journeyperson. So they have journeyperson upgrade programs that are pretty much required for most of the trades. So they require you, you know, to do like 8 hours a year to go back to the school and learn something else. A lot of times technology changes. So if you did your apprenticeship 10 years ago and there's new technology, you'll get to learn about that new technology. So it makes you a better craftsperson overall. I kind of mentioned that total wage package included in there is the benefits, which is the health and welfare. You know, that's all paid by the contractor that you work for. It's part of the total wage package. That includes medical, prescription, dental, vision, accident benefits. And not only are you covered, but your entire family is covered, whether you're single or whether you have a family of 8, everybody's covered by the health and welfare package. And then there's retirement plans as well. That's also paid by the contractors. Investments are managed by a group of management and labor trustees who oversee the investments. It's similar to a 401k, but your investments are managed by people who get trained on how to manage investments. So when you retire, you could retire comfortably. And a lot of these trades also offer alternative investment options such as annuities that you can opt in as an individual as well. So One of the other cool things is there's unlimited options of what you can do when you're in the trades. If you want to do road and bridge work, you have the opportunity to do that. A lot of people opt for that because they get the winters off. You can't really do asphalt paving or bridge construction in the winter. So a lot of these people work, and they work a lot of overtime between March and November. And with all the money that they make during that time period, they could stock money away and then take the entire winter off. So you could work for companies like Walsh & Kelly or Reith Riley or Superior Construction. These are some of your bigger road contractors. Some people gravitate towards commercial building and new construction. These are people that build new schools and hospitals, you know, companies like Hasse Construction, Powers & Sons, Berglin Construction, Larson Danielson, Tun & Blank Construction are some of the local contractors. There's also specialty like excavation and underground utilities contractors. So like companies that come to mind if you want to do excavation and underground utilities is like Grimmer Construction, Dyer Construction, GE Marshall. And then a lot of people like to work in industrial setting. There's a lot of overtime in industrial, and it's challenging work. So some of your industrial contractors might be like BMW Constructors, Graycore, Matrix NAC, Vitamos Construction. There's also a lot of specialty contractors as well. So specialty contractors kind of have niche duties on what they do. One that comes to the top of my mind is Thatcher Engineering. They do pile driving and foundations. They do a lot of seawall work. So it's very specialized work. So that's one of the cool things about construction is there's unlimited opportunities on what you can do. And you can kind of find a home in a bunch of different places. You have the ability to travel. So once you learn these skills, I mean, you possess these skills for life. So, you know, I've had friends that worked on very, very cool projects throughout the United States. A good friend of mine recently worked at Mercedes-Benz Stadiums, which is the new football stadium that they built in Atlanta a few years ago. I had friends that went down to New York and worked on cable stay bridges, you know, going over the Hudson River. So these workers are in demand not only here in Northwest Indiana, but all over the country. Lastly, there's career advancement opportunities. A lot of people in management have worked their way up through the crafts. Typically how that works is, you know, you pay your dues in the crafts and you work hard and your managers see that and they'll offer you a position into management. Well, they'll give you some extra training to, you know, how to read project schedules and how to plan projects, how to manage people. And along with that comes like higher pay. You know, a lot of times you get a company truck and a gas card. So a lot of reasons why you might want to consider a career in the union construction industry. Well, that's all the time I have today on Building Northwest Indiana. If you're interested in a career in the Northwest Indiana construction industry, you can find out more information at WeBuildNWI.com or just do an internet search for We Build Northwest Indiana. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation. You can hear Building Northwest Indiana on Tuesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts of Building Northwest Indiana are also online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help build stronger ties within and across our communities.
I think depression is more than sadness. It's so much deeper and it's so much harder to fight through. It's something that can keep you from doing things. And it's the same with anxiety. Anxiety is the feeling, for me, of when your heart rate's beating really fast, but you can't slow it down. You get worked up over these things that people do every day, and it's just little things that people don't understand why you're having trouble with, but it's not something you can control. When people say bad things about you, it's sometimes hard to let them go, especially when you have anxiety and depression. So for a really long time, I held on to these ideas that I wasn't worthy. No one would ever love me. I was undeserving. I was just the worst person ever. I was stupid. I was a whore. Just all of these negative things that people had said about me that because of my depression and anxiety, I held on to. When I started going to counseling, I definitely got a lot of comments about how I was unstable or crazy. I just started ignoring it. And the way I think of it is that counseling, getting mental health help, is just like what you would do if you had an ear infection or something was wrong with your leg, or you had a broken bone. It's just a kind of medical therapy to help you get better. And I'm very much a person of, you shouldn't be ashamed of anything. And so I talked about it. People acted like these were just temporary emotions that would just go away over time, like a crush or something. I think people fear what they don't understand, which is frustrating, but at the same time, we have to be empathetic with that. Growing up in a small town, I didn't always understand different cultures and races and the problems that they faced. And when I came to Valpo, that's one of the things I really wanted to learn about. And I think it's the same with mental health. If you don't have those issues, you still need to learn about them because they're still relevant socially. So in today's society, we have this concept of allyship and being an ally. We can be allies in so many different ways to different races and genders and sexualities. People don't think about being allies for mental illness. It's so easy to just say, hey, no, that preconceived notion is wrong. Hey, that's a stereotype. Whether you have a mental disorder, a mental illness or not, being an ally is important. We should all be allies to each other for mental health and for everything else.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The General Assembly is still in session, dealing with bills that have come up and moving from one house to another. And now it's time for measures that have come out of the Indiana House to be reviewed in the Senate. One of the bills in particular we're going to find out about is the one that has a major impact on Northwest Indiana and, in fact, the entire state of Indiana. It deals with public utilities and, in particular, with coal-fired generating plants, like the ones that NIPSCO continues to own here in Northwest Indiana. Jesse Carbonda is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And Jesse and his colleagues are keeping watch on the State House. In fact, Jesse is probably, are you standing right in the rotunda of the State House right now, I suppose?
Not too far, Chris.
I was going to say, because we can hear people out there milling around, and that's quite all right because it's a very busy place these days.
The one bill
in particular that we are all keeping an eye on is, and you as well, is House Bill 1414. Will you take a minute and talk a little bit about what that bill is all about, the sponsors for the measure, and where it stands right now, because it is coming up, I guess, in committee very soon.
Absolutely. Well, it's great to be back on, Chris. This is arguably the most contentious bill going on in the General Assembly this session, and it has to do with coal, and it has to do with putting up a roadblock to electrical utilities retiring their old plants and replacing them with cleaner, zero carbon emitting resources. And this bill barely passed the House on a vote of 52-41. It's sponsored by Representative Soliday of Valparaiso. And now it is awaiting a hearing before the Senate Utilities Committee.
What seems to be the major point that Representative Soliday's measure is asking for, and why is it such a contentious measure this time around, it seems?
Well, the rationale from his vantage point, the explicit rationale that Representative Soliday has raised, is that Indiana is in the middle of pursuing an energy task force. They will have a report coming out of the Utility Regulatory Commission by June of this year, and then a final report by the commissioners of the task force by the end of this year. And then during this period of time, there would be this quote-unquote pause on retirements. Coal plant retirements during this period of time. That's the purported rationale for the bill. For us, we're worried about the real negative signal that this sends to clean energy, for which there are now 86,900 jobs at the least in clean energy in the state. Compare that with 2,500 jobs in coal mining, according to the Department of Natural Resources. So we're worried that when you're sending this signal that, hey, wait a minute, we're not going to let you decide whether or not you can retire your coal plant on your own economic analysis, we're worried about the kind of signal that sends to clean energy resources, which are inevitably going to replace these coal plants as these coal plants retire.
Does it seem that much of the testimony that came up when it was still in a measure that was in the Indiana House after it had been introduced there was focusing more on whether in turn utilities would have that opportunity to say and be able to prove to the public on their terms, at least, that it was important to close the plants down without mentioning the clean energy aspect of it?
Well, what's interesting, Chris, is that this has brought together an unprecedented coalition of opposition. And the rationale for why different organizations and companies are opposed to it are different. The utility certainly kind of centered on this notion that their hands were being tied to carry on these decisions to retire coal plants, the vast majority of which are near the end of their life and over 40 years or if not 50 years old. But furthermore, from the vantage point of groups like us, clean energy is a rationale. There were groups focused on ratepayers, whether industrial and residential. And for them, there was worry that a few different provisions of the bill would ultimately end up increasing electricity rates. And on that point, I want to mention, Chris, to your audience, that at one time, Indiana had the fourth cheapest electricity in all of America, actually back in 2002, according to the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission. And now we are about 23rd. In America, in terms of low-cost power. So there's been a dramatic erosion in competitiveness of electricity prices in Indiana, and where we are concerned that HB 1414 will worsen that situation.
Now, we know that the Senate Utilities Committee is going to be taking this up and hearing next. Tell us about the committee, some of the members on it, and if they've given any kind of indication on this measure or others in the past that might be like it, what are they likely to talk about?
Well, this bill will go before the Senate Utilities Committee, and that is chaired by Senator Jim Merritt of Indianapolis. And I think that Senator Merritt has tended to be very close to the utilities, and that's been problematic from our vantage point for many years. But in this particular case, it might work in our favor, given that environmental groups like ours and the utilities are reasonably on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
In believing that this is not a necessary bill.
I know in particular Senator Merritt has in his district utility plants, like, for example, on the far south side of Indianapolis, that is in the process of making the change over to, I guess, eventually that it'll have to go to clean energy and eventually will close down over time, just as NIPSCO's plants and others around the state are going to have to do.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, in fact, the coal plant, there was a coal plant in Indianapolis, Harding Street, and that has already been converted to natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a couple of other plants that are within Indianapolis Power and Light, like the one in Petersburg, which are continue to be powered by coal.
Now, what do you see from the standpoint of the HEC that's going to come out when the Senate Utilities Committee has their meeting? When are they supposed to meet next? When's the hearing scheduled, by the way?
There is no date on the hearing. We're anticipating it will come next week.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you figured there'd be a big crowd of going to attending that hearing. We'd certainly know that the HEC will be there.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, and I can't emphasize that we have never seen just quite the diversity of different organizations and companies be in alignment in opposition to the bill. In fact, the only entity that supported the bill was the coal lobby when the bill was heard in committee in the House. And I wanted to mention, Chris, to your audience, given the focus on Northwest Indiana, that Senator Lonnie Randolph is on the Senate Utilities Committee as far as Northwest Indiana lawmakers.
That's good. Good to know that, too. So, well, Jesse, thank you for the update here and the information about House Bill 1414 that has made it out of the House and now in the Senate, coming up for a Senate hearing maybe as early as next week. And we appreciate the update, and we'll be watching, as you, very closely on how lawmakers vote on this measure that deals with coal-fired power plants. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris. And, you know, when there is time, we'd love to talk to your audience about SB 229, which is a bill that would seriously undermine wetlands protection, as well as SB 100, which is the resurrection of an effort to undermine public access to Lake Michigan.
That's great. That's great. I hope we have a chance we can get together next week again on the program and talk about those. That would be a great opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Jesse Carbonda is the Executive Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council. LaPorte County may soon be home to one of few industrial parks in the nation that can be served by two Class 1 rail carriers. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson talked with Randy Novak recently. He's the president of the LaPorte County Council, and he's also the president of the LaPorte County Redevelopment Commission, about the upcoming connection at the Kingsbury Industrial Park with the CSX mainline and what it's going to mean not only for the area, but also for the businesses that are already stationed in that LaPorte County park.
This is something years ago the county invested $6 million out there. There was a project. It was some cold storage that was going to be coming up out of Florida. And the county invested $6 million of major moves money out there on some rail. And we never made the project never came to be, and the connection was never made to the CSX. And so over the years, you know, it's kind of hard to market something when you don't have that connection there. So we're finally making that connection to the CSX, and at the same time, we're working on making the connection on the CN to the north also. So this should be, when we're all done, one of the only industrial parks that's served by two Class 1 railroads. We're excited about this. This is something that, you know, we've been working hard to get put together for many years.
So what would this enable you to do? Just take goods and from this rail yard to all over the country?
There's several businesses out there now that are working out there, and they're serviced by the South Shore to the, I guess it'd be the Northeast. This would open it up a lot more to the business, and it would help market all the property out there. There's a lot of unused properties out there.
Can you tell us how it would increase the opportunities for economic investment and job creation in LaPorte County?
This grant came to be because of a joint work with several people, that Matt Reardon, who works with our Redevelopment Commission, Tony Rodriguez, who's with the LaPorte County Economic Development, and Jim Pressel downstate, our state rep, and Mike Bohacek, our senator. And this is going to make it so that this property out there, for all the property owners, is so much more marketable and accessible, for the customers and the businesses that are already out there in that area. I mean, this is huge for anybody that wants to come to the area. It kind of opens it, just makes it wide open, because rail is so much cheaper than trucking and everything else. So.
Do you already have businesses that want to come out to LaPorte County if this project is done?
We always have people looking. So there's several, without saying anything, there's several people looking at properties out there. I don't know if you've ever been out there, but it's the old Kingsbury Ordnance plant. So it's a huge amount of acreage out there that's privately held by different people. And there's different businesses out there now, and this will just help market that. And it's in our TIP district, so, you know, we're trying to reinvest everything we can out there to help make this work for anybody that wants to come to LaPorte to create jobs. That's what it's all about, is creating more jobs in LaPorte County.
So this being the performance-based grant, what does LaPorte County have to do to secure the money?
LaPorte County's already invested $6 million on some of the rail that's out there. We did that, like I said, years ago with Major Moves. When that project was coming out there, NIPSCO has invested upwards of over $6 million on infrastructure out there, improving the electrical grid out there. JBC Rail has invested money out there. Lindbergh's have invested money in that area, you know, with the connection on the CN to the north. So we've already pretty much met all of our performance. And if it wasn't for those investments by us and by NIPSCO and the different companies that are out there, we would not be eligible for this grant.
So you guys have already pretty much fulfilled the work that you have to do to get the grant, so it's already done.
Correct. And the switch, we're hoping that the switch will come in less. We kind of got a ballpark price on what the switch would be. And installing the switch, and then there could be some of that $1 million left over for a little bit more infrastructure out there and some of the other rail connections and making improvements out there.
So is the building project, the actual connection, is it already done, or do you still have to build that?
No, the connection still has to be made. So we just got this word. We just had a meeting last night. So it was the first time that, you know, the board has acted on this and received the information that we got to grant. And so at our next meeting in February, we'll start moving forward with what we need to do to, you know, get a contractor in there and install this switch, for the CSX on the south there and get that all finalized. So we hope to have that in the works here in the next few months, at least have a plan set in place.
So is it just a switch that needs to be installed, or is it new rail tracks that have to be laid?
Correct. Right now, to make the connection to the CSX, it's a matter of making the hooking the switch in.
And what about this northern connection that you speak of to connect to the CN?
The northern connection, where the county redevelopment is currently in the process of acquiring some easements for the rail up there to make that connection. That switch is already in. It's a matter of making the rail connection from the CN to our rail that's already in the park.
Okay, so that means
a little bit different thing, but and we've got some private investors there also. We're acquiring the easements, and then the investor is going to make the connection.
So in summary, what are some dates that we can look forward to, or time periods, you know, if you don't have these specific dates, about when the connections will be made?
We're very hopeful that the connection on the CSX will be done sometime this summer. As soon as we get everything in place and get a contractor set up to make that connection, and then JBC Rail that's out there, that's invested quite a bit. They're the other ones that have made quite a bit of investment out there. They would, they did quite a bit of improvements to the tracks out there. So I would say, you know, as the weather kind of breaks, and the weather hasn't been that bad really, but I think in February meeting, we're going to have a little bit more better idea of a time frame to move forward with this. So, but with both projects, we're hoping in February, because we got some of those easements, so I think we're getting ready to kind of move forward on those. On the north connection on the CN, but the CSX, it like I said, the one to the south in this grant, it's, you know, with Doc Cora, the commissioner, he sits on the redevelopment also, and it's just been a great team effort to make this all come together.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson speaking with LaPorte County Council President Randy Novak. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The Griffith Police Department is not unique in having social workers on the staff. Erica Rios told us that she took advantage of some personal trauma to steer her life in that career direction. And she told us that it is a career that is challenging and satisfying.
I think that what led me to social work was just life. I think most people in this profession, something led them to it, to want to help people. In my particular circumstance, I really think that helping people has always been something I was interested in doing, but particularly back in 2003, my first husband was killed in Iraq, and it was a really tough time in my life, and I think at that moment in time, it being the beginning of the war, and a lot of people really weren't sure what to do. It had been a long time since there were mass casualties and notifications. Mm-hmm. I kind of fell through a lot of the cracks, and so not having anyone to turn to really sparked my interest in being that person people turn to when they were experiencing a crisis in their life.
In particular, it drew you, I guess, to the law enforcement side, so to speak, and the fact that people that end up being involved one way or the other with the police oftentimes need some kind of help?
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. And I think because this is an interesting arena for people, you know, police officers, first responders in general, you know, they come across people in times of need and crisis. And it's hopefully been a good tool for them to be able to use someone like me or with this background, you know, in their work.
How did it seem to fit when you got involved working here in particular with mm-hmm. the Griffith Police Department as to how you fit into the overall organization of the police department? Because police departments are always be known for having social workers, even though they are officers end up being social workers, I guess, on the spot, don't they?
Sure, absolutely. They're always referring people to services and things that they need, making suggestions and giving guidance. So how I fit here, you know, it just all kind of seems to fit together when officers are out doing their work and they come across someone that maybe has a need that is a little bit more intense or has a need that isn't as basic as, you know, maybe I need a little help with food, or I need a little help with housing, or maybe I just need somebody to talk to. You know, a lot of people are experiencing mental health issues, and it's just not something that they're totally equipped with dealing with. And so having a professional with a mental health background is really helpful.
Are you finding that that's what many of the opportunities that you have to talk to people out there, that maybe the officers have asked for your assistance on the street, so to speak, or maybe during an investigation of some kind, that it's because there's a problem that they feel they can't quite handle, but they know they can get somebody some help?
Sure, absolutely. That is definitely one of them. There are several, but I think for the most part, when I'm engaging with officers on the road, it is definitely mental health issues, domestic violence, sometimes family issues. Mm-hmm. People lose their jobs and they need a little bit of extra help to get them through. And then, of course, on the backside of things, in the investigative portion of it, I'm definitely not a detective, but I assist in any way that I can to try to help the people who are involved with our detective bureau get the help that they need.
Do you think maybe in that particular case, maybe one of the regular investigators on the force might have been talking to people and he's got some information, but maybe want to get a little bit more questions out from somebody they've talked to, and perhaps they turn to you to help come up with some ways to help them?
I think so. You know, it's always better to have two ideas or three ideas or the perspective of somebody who doesn't have a law enforcement background. So,
what seems to be the best way that you've been able to work with the officers here with the Griffith Police Department? Because it's not a big department, but it's in a community that's very diverse, and I guess they have their share of problems, of wide-ranging problems, I would imagine.
Sure. So I think that the way that I work with them, so I have a background with the Department of Child Services. I'm very familiar with having the social work background and the DCS background, very familiar with the area. I grew up here. I actually grew up in Griffith. So it's helpful for me to know the area, know the demographic, and actually know a lot of the families that have been here for generations. Mm-hmm. It's been very helpful to have the background through the state and working through DCS, understanding the court systems, understanding what is actually out there for families who have needs, and especially kids. Kids are often forgotten sometimes, not just in the world of law enforcement, but in the school arena. I think sometimes people forget that there are children involved in situations, and sometimes they're overlooked. So it's been really good for me to be able to put all of my experience to work, and then with this degree and being able to, really show what I can do.
You mentioned young people. Are there times on occasion that the Griffith Public Schools ask for you to help them out? They may have, of course, specialists or people they turn to on a regular basis, but sometimes they maybe need a little extra help, and do they turn to you even though you're with the police department?
Well, and so it's funny that you would ask that. I'm actually contracted by the schools to work there 50% of the time. So mm-hmm. I spend three of my work days during the school year, three of my work days during the week at the school. And they certainly do use that knowledge base that I have. So I try to help bridge the gap between outside communities and agencies and the school, improving relationships and better outcomes for our kids.
Give us just an example of a situation where you may be called in. Maybe it's a case where an officer is having some problems out there. He's dealing with somebody at an apartment complex, of which there are several in Griffith. Mm-hmm. And you may have some problems, they may have some problems with somebody. And then there's some youngsters that are involved in the mix as well, too. Give us an idea of what sorts of things that you, when you get into a situation and they're asked for help, do you find that you have to kind of start first to look at and what steps you tend to take and whatever help you can give?
So I think in a situation like you mentioned, mm-hmm. you're going into a situation with a family who has come into the scope of law enforcement for one reason or another, mm-hmm. Whatever that may be. Because I have access to both the systems and the police department on the law side and at the school, I can kind of check out with those kids, you know, what's going on at school, what's going on at home. It's easier to really identify what a problem can be from a holistic perspective and not just from law enforcement or just from school or just from social work. So I try to piece all those things together like a puzzle to give the family a better picture of what's going on and what we can possibly do to help them.
Yeah. Now, even though you have been involved in many, many cases of certain types, are there any other that you've been able to follow through on that have come up with some very positive and satisfying results?
Yes. In fact, I follow up on quite a few things. And we have one example that I could think of was a gal here in town who was having some domestic violence issues. And we were able to piece together some family members and things that she needed and to get her just out of the situation that she was in and to live with relatives far away. We were able to get her to a safe place very quickly. We were able to put that family piece back in with them. Residents here in town who have come across maybe needing some income or rent assistance, things like that. Something's falling down around them. They're not really sure where to go to get the help, and have followed up with people saying, hey, you know, do you remember me? You know, I needed help with my basement that flooded back when the pipes burst in January. Things are going really great. And as you mentioned before, it's a small town. A lot of people know each other, go to church together, work together. Their kids go to school together. And so working in the town where I grew up, people grab me quite frequently when I'm out doing things and saying, hey, you helped my so-and-so do this, or you helped my friend do that. You know, so it's really kind of cool to see that.
Are there any ideas or areas that maybe you've kind of conferred with Chief Mance and his other senior officers about that you would like to, if you're not already involved in, that you might like to be involved in over time?
You know, truthfully, there are two things that I really would like to start doing that I haven't had the chance to do because I seem to be busy. A lot busier than I ever imagined I would be. Mm-hmm. One is to develop a wellness or peer support program for our law enforcement officers, which would include current officers, former officers, and retired officers. That community really just, they need the support of each other. And I think in the climate of law enforcement, as what we're seeing across the spectrum with suicide and things of that nature, it's better to get ahead of the problem before it starts. Or before it presents itself. And the second thing is I would really like to start providing more community trainings, whatever that looks like. Faith-based community is open to having me come and do training such as suicide prevention, child protection training, discussing child abuse and neglect, discussing human trafficking, you know, things that do touch our lives, but not everybody really either knows about or wants to talk about. So raising awareness to be able to prevent things from happening is a passion of mine.
Erica, thank you very much for explaining what your job as the social worker for the Griffith Police Department is all about, and I hope that things go well, not only for you, but for the rest of the department into the new year.
Thank you.
That's Griffith Police Department social worker Erica Rios. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow. We have a conversation with Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy coming up. We hope you'll be with us then.